Live from the SiriusXM studios in New York City, this is Busted Open. Your only destination for daily pro wrestling talk in the entire world. From the independent scene to the main event of WrestleMania, no one covers pro wrestling like Busted Open.
Eddie Guerrero was busted open.
Hot topics, breaking news, and interviews with some of the biggest names in the game. A show designed for the fan, by the fan. Old school.
The irritable force meeting the immovable object.
Meets new school.
Hulk Hogan has betrayed WCW.
Busted Open.
Austin 316 says I just whipped your ass.
Live now. Here are your hosts, Dave LaGreca and ECW legend Tommy Dreamer.
Ooh, welcome to the Busted Open Miracle on the Mat Barely Legal Anniversary Spectacular with myself, Dave LaGreca, and the innovator of violence, the landlord of the House of Hardcore, the one and only Tommy Dreamer. Tommy, how the hell are you, man?
I'm doing wonderful. I even dressed up for the occasion. It's been a long time since I've worn a wrestling shirt, but I put it on. It still fits. I still got my arm heat. Gabby's smiling. I could see her in the Zoom room. So it works. I'm not going to stand up because then I'll have like a blue meanie. My love handles will pop up and because this shirt's tight.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the Blue Meanie, because the Blue Meanie is going to be joining us on this very special, Barely Legal, Miracle on the Mat anniversary special today. And then I also know that Beulah is also going to be a part of this spectacular as well. And I have my Tommy Dreamer, innovator of violence, landlord of the House of Hardcore,
nice
T-shirt on.
You're working out. I see.
Yeah.
It.
Hey, you know what? What else are you going to do when you're quarantined?
Do push-ups. So, I work out all the time now. It's great.
But seriously, I mean, you know, we're having some fun because it is about having fun, and I hope everyone's staying safe and making the best of this really terrible situation. But, you know, we talk about this week being a special week in pro wrestling because it is the anniversary, April 13th, 1997, a very special pay-per-view called ECW's Barely Legal, Tommy.
Yeah, and, you know, in thinking about this and prepping for the show, I was watching a reunion of the Olympics. The Olympic team is 40 years. And to me, you know, and that was the Miracle on the Ice. And this was something that this pay-per-view, this company, it should have never have gotten to the heights that it did. And when we talk about things that happened or all the setbacks going into this and how we literally put this entire show together, and all the obstacles, it truly was a miracle that it actually happened. And, you know, the fact that ECW grew the way it did, and it kind of reminded me of, you know, the emergence of AEW, where all of a sudden, and there was so much speculation and doubt in a short while, but that they were going to be able to pull off a pay-per-view. Then it was like, oh my gosh, we're going to pull off TV. I see so many correlations during this. So I just thought it was a cool time to do it. I don't think we should talk about it till the 25th year, then the 30th, and then 35, 40, then 50. I'll probably be dead by the 50th. I'll be dead by like 52nd. So it's okay. I'm all right with that.
Hey, Ed, you've lived a charmed life. And going back to that special date, because it really was a special date, and you kind of felt it at the time too, Tommy. I was in my early 20s when Barely Legal took place. And that was like the perfect pro wrestling product for my time. You know, that was, you know, ECW is like you go to the bars with the guys and then you come back and watch ECW late at night. It was the perfect pro wrestling organization for its time.
Yeah. And, you know, that time, it was 1997. So it's, you know, late 90s, but the mid 90s, man, wrestling changed. ECW was changing the landscape of the industry, where, you know, it was WWF was very, very commercial, cartoonish, with a lot of characters, and same with WCW. It was, the business wasn't talked about how we talk about it today, and this was like the first shock into the system. And we always say it was like the hair bands of the 80s, and then grunge came along, and it pretty much killed the hairband era. Same with like ECW. We just burst out on the scene and we were just gaining this momentum where everybody was talking about it. And you had to, back then, if you wanted to make your company legit as well as make money, you had to get on pay-per-view, because it wasn't like how it is today with streaming services, everything for free. This was, if you made it to pay-per-view, you were next level. And I'm talking next level making money. You had an influx of cash when you had buy rates. And it was something that in one night can turn your business around, just like the first WrestleMania did for WWE. It was, if when WrestleMania hit and they started getting all those numbers back, it was like, whoa, we're on to something.
Yeah, and I think you're right. When this hit pay-per-view, even for myself, just as a fan of ECW, it's like, all right, this is legit. It kind of reminded me when, you know, Metallica went on tour with Ozzy. It was like, all right, now this music is being taken seriously. It was the same thing with this pay-per-view. It's like, all right, now ECW is being taken seriously. And it was really a sign of the times to the music, the entrance themes that were being used. Like you mentioned, the WWF was very, very cartoonish. Comparing the entrance themes from some of the WWF superstars to the ECW wrestlers was like night and day. And then, you know, seeing Raven with a Ministry t-shirt on it, ECW was really the sign of the times for that mid to late 90s.
Oh, dude, absolutely. Sandman coming out to Metallica. And you also, when we talk about a different time, you know, we were just using music without rights, without anything, just putting it on the air. Paul's defense was it was always played ambient, which meant it was just played through the crowd. So it wasn't like how wasn't piped in directly to the live feed. Everything we did in ECW was pretty much illegal. Leading up to this too, I got to tell you about, I'll never forget it. We used to do kind of like State of the Union addresses in the back, as well as we used to do it in front of the fans. And we announced a couple shows before that we were going to take it to pay-per-view. And the place was nuts. And ECW, we were a family. Like, we were a family in the back. We were also a family of the fans. And we always say Philadelphia for being something special. And when that was like, it caught on like wildfire, and then the mass transit incident happened. And it was, someone sent the tape to Wade Keller, and he went out, put it out there. Then we got, and if you think about it, you know, the internet was just really starting, but it was like dirt sheets. And then this product, what happened to us in Revere, without like a court case, without anything, this incident, and he described it as like a butchering, all this stuff, we got kicked off of pay-per-view, and we lost our original pay-per-view date because of really a dirt sheet. And it really affected our business, and it pissed a lot of people off, because it was like, how, and they would always talk good about ECW, but then how do you go and do this to the company that everybody wanted to, off of an event that, you know, at the time we were just like, hey man, it happened, but it got blown out of proportion. That event has lived in infamy as well. But when we had to cancel our date, it was devastating. And then finally, when we were able to work it out, Barely Legal was only carried, there was two pay-per-view providers, and it was only carried on one, the first one. So we only had half the market.
And, you know, you still had over 100,000 buys, and probably, you know, would have been a lot more, because that was also the time of the illegal boxes that a lot of people used as well. And, you know, but that was really on the tip of every wrestling fan's tongue. And you mentioned about, you know, 40 years since, you know, Do You Believe in Miracles, when the U.S. hockey team beat Russia. You know, I remember Joey Styles at the end of that pay-per-view when Terry Funk, you know, won that ECW championship. He said, "Do you believe in miracles?" And that wasn't just talking about Terry Funk, a living legend, winning that title. It was just about the whole show, ECW getting on pay-per-view in front of a sold-out crowd, in front of the ECW arena. That was more of a rallying cry, more for the company than it was for Terry Funk winning that championship.
Absolutely, because of all the obstacles we had to face going in. Another thing, to his credit, man, Paul Heyman fought with the pay-per-view companies, because he said, I have to do this first pay-per-view in Philadelphia. It has to be at the ECW arena. This was our home. And if you go back and look at it, that was the nicest that place at the time had ever looked. But the building actually made several improvements so they can have this pay-per-view there. But man, Paul stuck to his guns because he was like, this is our home people. I have to give this to them because they stood by me since day one. And as a boss, that was one hell of a decision. Also, leading up to this, I wasn't on the show and I was devastated. And I was so pissed because, you know, here I am pretty much, I don't want to say the most loyal, but like I was, you know, become the face of the brand and I wasn't on the, I didn't have a match on the first pay-per-view. And in hindsight, thinking about it, and I was pissed. And then I remember always me and Paul, we would argue, but we'd also have some great discussions. And he was just like, listen, when he came up with this whole angle for Terry Funk, he's like, Terry Funk's an older wrestler and this is his last shot at the world championship. And he's a former NWA champion. And he goes, I gave my title shot to Terry Funk. And he goes, because that's what Tommy Dreamer would do. And at times, you know, we all had a lot of creative freedom, but something like that, Paul saw things in that where even if I argued with him, but then at the end, I knew he was right. And that was the beauty of ECW and the relationship that not only Paul had with myself, but with a lot of guys.
And Tommy, you mentioned about not being on the show, but your presence was felt in that main event to end that pay-per-view. And that's something we're going to get into. You and I are also going to be doing a watch along that's going to be on the SiriusXM app and on Busted Open podcast that definitely a lot of people should subscribe to because we're giving that extra content to. And you and I are going to sit down and we're going to watch. And I'm sure you're going to have a lot of stories when it comes to that main event at Barely Legal. But when we come back, let's get into the show. Let's get into the card. We also have two amazing guests that are going to tell their side of what happened on that fateful night, April 13th, 1997. The first ever ECW pay-per-view, Barely Legal. We're going to have the Blue Meanie joining us and also Beulah, who's sitting by your side during that main event at Barely Legal. We got a lot to get into, and we're going to do it when Tommy and I are back right here on a special edition of Busted Open.
You're listening to Busted Open's Miracle on the Mat special on SiriusXM Fight Nation, channel 156.
This week on World of Basketball, Australia's five-time Olympian and FIBA Hall of Famer, Andrew Gaze, shares his thoughts on LaMelo Ball as an NBA prospect.
I think he's a phenomenal talent. He's good size. He's a really, really good athlete. But in NBA, the standards, he's not an elite athlete. He can pass the ball. The thing that I think impressed me the most is not necessarily everything I saw on the floor, because his talent is really good, but he listens. He's respectful, and that he seems to buy into the team concepts.
New episodes of World of Basketball are available every Thursday on the SiriusXM app and Pandora.
Dave LaGreca and Tommy Dreamer look back on ECW's Barely Legal. This is Busted Open's Miracle on the Mat special.
Here on Busted Open, a very special edition of Busted Open. It's the Busted Open Barely Legal Miracle on the Mat anniversary show with your own Tommy Dreamer and Dave LaGreca, and somebody who was a big part of April 13th, 1997, Tommy, is Beulah McGillicuddy, who joins us live right here on Busted Open. Beulah, how are you today?
I'm doing great. I'm not sick, so that's a good thing.
Yes, thank you. Please stay safe, and everybody practice social distancing during this very, very difficult time. But, I mean, you know, when you call somebody and they don't come on, then you know they really don't want to come on because everybody's home. So if they don't answer your phone call, you know that they really don't want to talk to you. I appreciate you answering the phone and coming on today.
Anytime.
And so, Beulah and I are practicing social distancing because I was out and about in the public and I've been living downstairs. She's upstairs. I think we've been practicing social distancing for about the last 10 years. She keeps on trying to get away from me for a while.
Hey, it was all building up to this.
Right next to me.
Well, I'm glad. I was wondering why, you know, you're both on from different rooms. Now we know why. And this is coming off the heels, Tommy, of your House of Hardcore podcast was your most downloaded episode was with Beulah. So it's really good.
That's right.
And you blew away the Dave LaGreca episode. So I'm jealous.
Stop blowing up her head, please. I got to be quiet.
And it wasn't enough for one episode. You did two episodes. So
she had a long career.
She definitely did. And April 13th. So Beulah, when you look back at that date, because Tommy and I talked about how important that was for ECW. How important was that show for you on April 13th, Barely Legal?
Well, I felt it was such a huge accomplishment, and it was, I would say, not at like a team effort, but something that everybody wanted, it's fans included. I mean, if I had to describe that pay-per-view, I would say it was the people's pay-per-view because they, I mean, honestly, if I remember correctly, and Tommy, correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of places didn't want to carry the pay-per-view, but the people were calling their cable stations and demanding that they air it. Was that true? Yep. Okay. So I feel like it was important for us because it was important to the fans.
And if you think about today, you know, we have campaigns where you just go on social media to try to get people or even like GoFundMes. This was fans saying, why are you not carrying this pay-per-view? And we would do, Joey Styles would do inserts basically telling people to call your local cable provider to get this pay-per-view. And that's how big it was. And another side note from this, I remember, and you know, Dave and I, you've discussed this, referee Tim White for the WWE, he would go on the road and then he worked in the office and he literally would come back from the road with phone books and his job working for the WWE going into WrestleMania 3, he would take a phone book and call every single person in a phone book and just go down the list and tell them to order that WrestleMania 3. So this was our version of, hey, you have to order this pay-per-view.
And when you look at Barely Legal, now a lot of this was featured in the movie Beyond the Mat, that documentary, and it really showed how ECW was almost like a mom and pop store. Like it was, you know, everybody working together and behind the scenes and in the ring. Beulah, would you say that was a pretty good assessment of what ECW was back then?
It was, and it's almost like if I had to compare it to something, I would say like if you had a mom and pop pizza place and all of a sudden they broke out into a chain, right? And you know, because they had so much interest, I would say it's almost like that for us. That's how it felt, was that, you know, all of a sudden, you know, somebody found out that we have the best, you know, fried chicken in the world, and now you've got all these people who are interested in it. That's how it felt for me.
No, and what was the vibe? What was the vibe in the back? Because you saw little scenes of it with Paul Heyman in that documentary, but what was it like in the back with everybody while this pay-per-view was going on?
I feel like it was, holy crap, I can't believe they let us do this. No, it was definitely, I think we all took pride in the fact that we were doing something very important for the company.
You know, Dave, I totally forgot they were filming for Beyond the Mat, which was, you know, it's available on Netflix, but it was the first real behind the scenes documentary of what was going on in the world of professional wrestling. And Paul knew those cameras were there. And sometimes when, you know, now we know is scripted reality, we knew, and Paul was like purposely placing people where to stand. And I remember like he used to do a lot of those speeches like that before and then at the end, but like I'll always remember the "This is the dance" part of that promo. And Paul was a great motivator. He, as you still know, he's an amazing speaker. And that was a locker room full of men and women who literally would have done anything for him and the fans that night, like we did most nights. But it was definitely, it was It was supposed to be life-changing for all of us, for the company at times it was, and it was also getting on pay-per-view was the first obstacle. The next pay-per-view actually helped us where it was carried by everyone, and then we were doing a lot of great numbers, and then sadly it also led to the eventual fall of the company because we were producing, our numbers were better than WCW's, and it, you know, you had, we were always so financially unstable with actual liquid cash flow, and the whole pay-per-view system is, you know, we've discussed this before, it's like legal extortion back in the day of how it was, how you got on pay-per-view, how you stayed on pay-per-view, how you eventually got paid for pay-per-views. So, but that day in particular, I remember like everyone was dressed so well, you know, it was just, it had a different complete vibe in the locker room. It really, really did.
When Beulah, you mentioned, and Tommy, you mentioned it too, the fans. And earlier Tommy talked about how that show had to be in Philly at the ECW Arena. So Beulah, for you, what was it like being in your home, being in Philly, being in the ECW Arena? You know, kind of explain to our fans what the vibe was for the fans, and how important was it for this first ever pay-per-view to be in South Philly?
It was of the utmost importance. It was almost like we owed them, because I don't want to say that they, you know, completely made us, but the fans in Philly they stuck by us through thick and thin. It didn't matter, you know, what was happening. They were always going to be there for us. And to not go there would have been a slap in the face. We really, I mean, no other place would have done it for a first pay-per-view. They really deserved it. And they wanted it probably more than anybody else in the world too. They wanted to be part of that. And the fans there were so involved in the matches. They were so invested in it I feel like they would just have been crushed if we hadn't had it there. And the feeling was so electric. I remember specifically looking out there and seeing, I mean, talk about the opposite of social distancing. That place was packed like sardines. I mean, there had to be some kind of fire code broken that night, because they were like all packed, and the energy was so electric because they knew that they were part of something special too.
It's funny that, you know, she says that. She was like, hey, can I go and watch Barely Legal? It was probably the first time you've watched it since the first time it aired, you know?
Yeah.
And she just started laughing, because if you go back and watch what the show opened up with, Beulah, can you please share?
The first shot you see is a sign that says, Bischoff sucks ass. I was like, yeah, okay.
Hilarious. It's Joey Styles in the arena. But the first thing you see is a picture of a fan holding up a sign that says Bischoff sucks ass, which is, you know, right in your face. You knew this day was going to be different. And the best part about Paul Heyman, and the best part, even though we did make it to pay-per-view, and as you said, you know, when Metallica started touring, and even Nirvana, you know, they went to number one. They never lost that sold out vibe, and we never did. So it was that was as important part too. And then
and the fact that he never watered down the product for it.
Correct. I mean, if you think about going into it, the advertised match, Taz versus Sabu, had a 1-year build with the guys never facing each other, touching each other, having one match against each other. Then the next one was, you know, the three-way dance for Raven's title. And it was Terry Funk, Sandman, Stevie Richards, and the BWO had just gone fire. And the Shane Douglas, Pitbull feud. Also, Rob Van Dam was in there. Lance Storm was a last-minute replacement for Chris Candido. And he also brought in, which we were famous for, but not really at that time, when we brought in the Japanese wrestlers, and we Japanese six-man match. Hadn't been seen something like that in a long, long time.
Yes.
Yeah, but I feel like that was something for everybody then, you know, adding that element to it.
Yep. And the feud of, you know, the Dudleys versus the Eliminators for the ECW tag titles, which the tag titles meant everything. And I joke about it, but, you know, Bully Ray going into this, he broke his ankle and I had passed over my famous walking boot. Oh, no, I'm sorry, because mine happened later. He cut off his cast that night to go work that pay-per-view, and doctor said, you should not work it. And he was like, no, I have to work it. And then later he passed that same walking boot to me when I broke my heel.
Amazing. That's amazing. And then you talk about that sign that started the pay-per-view. There was just those loud chants of ECW, and that quickly changed to Dudley suck right at the start of that, because they were in the first match, which is funny when you watch it back. So Beulah, for you, like, watching it back, because Tommy just said that you hadn't watched that in years, what was it like to, you know, to sit back, because you being a part of that, being a huge part of it, you know, you at the commentator's table during that main event, what was going on with Tommy, what was it like for you to go back and watch that after all these years?
I had a sense of pride, for one, because I had forgotten about most of the stuff that had transpired. I mean, mostly because I wasn't really involved much with Barely Legal. You know, since Tommy didn't have like an actual match, I wasn't there. I wasn't doing much either. I was up in the Eagle's Nest up there with Joey Styles and Tommy. So, but reliving the moments of the crowd reactions, I always took great pride in how all of us were able to get those highs and lows from people, and just get the, that extreme, pop or whatever you want to call it. Those are like the proud moments, and the fact that nobody thought that ECW would ever be big enough to have a pay-per-view. And here we were, against the odds, producing something, putting something out there that probably should have never been, you know, on most networks.
Did you feel, and this is for both of you, did you feel that finally ECW got its respect? Like, did you feel like things started to change for the company after that night?
For me, no, because one, we were still kind of blacklisted from both pay-per-views, and it wasn't in, what was that? I think it was like, man, I forget. It was DirecTV and another pay-per-view carrier. There was only two. And the fact that we were only on a limited amount was like, oh, we're still not getting the justification that we should. And this was also like, this was make or break for us too, because we did not know if we could get to the next one. And if you also want to talk about like not knowing where you're going or what's going to transpire after this, as much as there was people that liked the show, I remember at the end of the show going back, me and Paul, we weren't really happy with a lot of, and some of the talent weren't happy with a lot of the matches, because we were under such pressure and we were such perfectionists, and we didn't feel that it delivered in the way we wanted it. I don't know how she feels.
Who was unhappy with it? If you just, I don't know what matches you're speaking of. Like, who was unhappy?
Sabu, Paul was like, it didn't live up to the build. Shane and Pitbull wasn't what he wanted. The three-way was totally what they wanted. And, you know, the emotion that was captured afterward.
What pay-per-view, sorry, Tommy, what pay-per-view was it where Taz went through the ring? Was that Taz that went through the ring?
Yes, and that was the one in Asbury Park.
Okay.
But for a match that had a build up for so long, and I don't think either guy liked it, if memory serves me correct, because it wasn't the match that, after a year-long build, and it was Paul who, like, I remember Taz wanting to be the main event because he was the advertised main event, and then Paul just changed it to get what he wanted. And it worked out better because the match wasn't what those two guys had wanted. But if you also talk about difficulty, Dave, I don't know if Beulah remembers, to get up to the Eagle's Nest, it's no longer there. You had to climb up these rickety spiral staircase that someone had to hold on the top or else you were going to fall over. Like, so someone had to hold the actual stairs and we could only go one at a time as we would walk up there. Do you remember that?
That was like, that pretty much sums it all up right there.
So you had to risk your life to get up there. And I remember the thing with Big Dick Dudley where I had to throw him off there. He couldn't, and you had to literally come up through a hole in that area. And he couldn't fit, and he's like 300 and some odd plus pounds. And he used to walk like Frankenstein. And he was like in the background, he's like, bro, what the fuck, bro. Because he couldn't get up to get his spot because
there were
like two people trying to hold this rickety staircase that you had to climb up to get to. And you also, it was like there was a half door. You had to step over trash to try to climb up into this little hole. And I remember Beulah was wearing like all white and she was like, oh my God, I'm going to be filthy going through this.
Oh my gosh. That's funny.
That's amazing. So Beulah, for you, what's the lasting impression? Like when, I mean, did you ever think, even after that night was over, did you really think that, you know, here, you know, we'd be talking about this over 20 years later?
I never dreamed the stuff that we were going to do was going to be talked about even 2 years or 3 years down the road from that. Like I never, it still surprises me today. Like it shocks the heck out of me when somebody even remembers who I was. That blows me away. I'm like, how do you remember that? You know, it's flattering and amazing to me that it became what it was. I think we were all just giving it our all and that was the best we could do and didn't realize that it would become what I would, I guess, maybe term a cult classic years later.
No, and it's something that's still being talked about. And again, you still hear ECW chants everywhere you go at every pro wrestling show. Whenever, you know, a chair is shown or a table is shown and, you know, whenever Tommy's on the cards, you always hear those ECW chants. So thank you so much, Beulah. I really appreciate the time and hopefully we can
see me
soon.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
All right, Beulah McGillicuddy talking about Barely Legal. When we come back, Tommy, we're going to talk to Blue Meanie right here on a very special edition. It's the Busted Open Barely Legal Miracle on the Mat anniversary special right here. I'm Busted Open.
You're listening to Busted Open's Miracle on the Mat special on Sirius XM Fight Nation, channel 156.
Soccer is a passion that goes beyond the sport, and Sirius XM FC's podcast, More Than a Game, brings that passion to you.
Can you believe it?
In each episode, FC's panel of experts take a deep dive into club histories, iconic grounds,
Anfield has erupted,
bitter rivalries, and so much more.
There's nothing like a derby day in Manchester.
New episodes are available weekly by downloading the Pandora app and searching More Than a Game.
This is Busted Open's Miracle on the Mat special, celebrating the anniversary of ECW's Barely Legal. Here is Dave LaGreca and ECW legend Tommy Dreamer.
Back here on Busted Open, the Busted Open special, the Miracle on the Mat, Barely Legal, happy birthday, happy anniversary edition of this very special episode. And Tommy, we already talked to Beulah right now, live on the line, as promised. The Blue Meanie joins us here on a first time here on Busted Open. How are you, sir?
Hey, how's it going, guys? Happy to be here. I listen every day, so it's really cool for you guys to have me on. So
well,
I'm loving it.
I appreciate it. And also, you are now hosting your own podcast called The Mind of the Meanie, and you can follow that on at Mind of the Meanie. On Twitter and on social media. And how's that going for you? How's the show going?
The new podcast, Mind of the Meanie, has been a lot of fun. We had to rush it ahead of time because of this whole, we were going to do it next month and we're like, man, we're missing out on a lot of topics. So myself and Josh Chernoff, the co-host from Fight TV, are having a good time just getting together, talking, and it's kind of therapeutic in the times we're going through. So Mind of the Meanie across all podcast formats and social media formats. So, yes.
Well, if you ever need a guest, I'm not doing anything.
Hey, man, we're all in our pajamas, you know, just hanging out, you know. Tommy's drinking his coffee. I'm being a little spritzy over here with my seltzers, and, you know, we'll have a party.
All right, we'll do it. Well, obviously, the topic of the day is, you know, this is the week, the anniversary of Barely Legal, April 13th, 1997. And, you know, there you were. I'm watching back the main event right before that three-way dance, and you got heavily involved in that match. So when you look back at that date and that first ever ECW pay-per-view, what comes to mind for you?
Very fortunate, man. We had all in ECW, as Tommy can vouch, you know, there's always been talk of pay-per-view leading up to that. And we weren't even sure leading, you know, up until the day of the pay-per-view, it was really happening. And then you show up at the ECW arena and they're like, man, they painted the floors. It's really nice in here. There's nice lighting. But as a kid who got to be a wrestling fan, I was in the stands for those first couple ECW shows when it was Eastern Championship Wrestling. I moved away for a year, trained with Al Snow. They come back and start joining the company. You know, it's kind of like, you know, if I played for the Philadelphia Phillies and it said, hey, you want to turn at bat? And I, you know, go up the home plate and that hit a couple. So just to be able to join ECW and then work all the way up to their very first pay-per-view, because they're in this business, there aren't that many firsts you can do in this business to be a part of something that's your first pay-per-view for a company like ECW was so mind-blowing, and it was awe-inspiring of everything that led up to it and the ups and downs and ins and outs of almost losing it. The when, you know, they count down, you know, I'm at ringside for that three-way dance and Todd Gordon's running around ringside going, we're running out of time. He's, you know, putting the pen in his mouth, waving, we're running out, tell him to take it home, Brian. And then I'm trying to feed the line to the, you know, referee, hey, we're running out of time, and he's feeding the guys, hey, we're running out of time. And
Dave, you know exactly what Meany's talking about, Dave, with the end of the beginning of this pay-per-view. If you watch the first match, Bob Ortiz is the ring announcer, and he's just standing there. And I remember, like, we had like one headset to communicate, and it was a guy sitting at the desk,
Rocky,
as well as Bob. Bob's standing there like this, frozen, and Paul, they're all screaming, "Go, go, go!" We didn't realize he was deaf in one ear, and he put the earpiece in the ear that he was deaf in. And then, like, they're signaling him to go, and then they went. And, like, after the show, they were like, how come you didn't tell us? Like, he goes, I couldn't hear. I'm deaf in that ear. And they're like, how come you didn't tell us? And the guy, he's like, the guy told me to put it in my right ear, so I just put it in my right ear, right? We didn't work with, like, material like that or stuff like that, or – we were literally using hand signals. Like, it was the guys on the Eagle Nest by the hard camera telling the other people, like, when to go. And what Brian is talking about, we're running out of time. Raven had, like, a classic line in the back when, you know, Terry Funk, that match is going over. The show is going over. And Paulie's screaming, like, you got to do this. And, like, Raven, like, in his calmness, as he's working out the curtain, he's like, Paul, don't worry. I got this. I'm a professional wrestler. Like, before he ran out and did that little spot where, you know, Terry Funk wins the title. And we went off the air, perfect timing. And, you know, with ECW, after that, we didn't use earpieces or headsets like that. We just were, and I know this is weird to say, we were so professional. We always hit our times and knew what to do for this group of, like, you know, when I think people go over their times or all that stuff, I want to say, man, we produced pay-per-views that changed the landscape of the business, like, with nothing, with not communication, but between the producers and the referees or the guys, Joey Styles. The stuff we did was just next level. Like, you think about in hindsight, like, that's why I always say, like, wrestling doesn't have to be this hard. But you think about what this group of men and women did and why, like I said, this is like a true miracle that it came off. And then at the end of the show, Brian remembers the lights went out.
Yeah.
It was 5 seconds after we went off the air. The transmitter blew because the building couldn't hold the power, the electricity that was going through. And we went dark. And for that moment, we were like, did we go off the air at the right time? Because we didn't know. And then I remember like Funk bleeding on all the fans. And like we finally made it to the top. His family was there. And like we, that's when we got the cue. We went off the air. We made it. And then like everyone was like, it was like this sigh of relief that we all as a company, but like as the fans, we like celebrated together. We'll never be able to capture moments like that ever. Because it was like the little engine that could, that couldn't finally did it. And it was just like, wow. And I remember telling people, we're off the air, and everyone exploded like, oh my God, we did it.
I mean, if you had done like a movie script to that, people would be like, oh, that's too corny. That's too hokey. There's no way that would happen. But everything that happened in ECW, you couldn't script.
Nope.
And the fact that I stood there as we went off the air and to see Joey Styles, I was 5 feet from him. He got emotional because he was literally crying, man tears, just because he got to call the pay-per-view by himself when the networks wanted to have him have a sidekick, and Paul fought for that. And to see guys just like openly hug and celebrate. And then there was like a little meeting that nobody even thought to record where Paul went out to the ring. And just like as we're talking right here, in his regular voice, talked to the crowd, and everybody was quiet, and the whole building was quiet. And he thanked everybody who came out.
And we had no microphone. That's why, because we lost power. And Paul literally, I totally forgot about that. I have chills just listening to it. Paul went out there. Dude, I totally forgot about that, because I watched it from the Eagle's Nest with Terry. Mm-hmm. And he went out there, and he was hoarse, as well as Paul broke down.
Yeah.
And it was like a moment where we saw Darth Vader being human. And he was, because he, you know, we all realized what we just did, where like the Miracle on Ice or that movie Cool Runnings with the Jamaican bobsled team, like it was, we weren't supposed to be there. We never were. We were a bunch of misfits. We were the company that nobody wanted. We were the wrestlers that no one wanted. And then as soon as that happened, we saw, like, I don't want to say it changed, but we saw we had value, and we had value within ourselves.
And the cool thing about it, I kind of knew we had value when, WCW folks are showing up to the pay-per-view and sitting in the audience, and WWE guys are WWE guys are coming to the show sitting in the audience.
Do you remember at Barely Legal 2, Paul had told us that there would be, like, spies, and there would be people trying to sabotage our show. I remember Kevin Sullivan, Public Enemy, and Harlem Heat showed up. Do you remember this?
Yes. Yes,
and
I do.
Paul wanted us to fight them. And I was just like, Paul, Kevin is our friend. So is the Public Enemy. And Harlem Heat are gigantic. I couldn't believe how big Steve really was.
We all did the Peter Griffin walk backwards. And
but like, Paul had us all, in a way, brainwashed that these guys were going to come and mess with our pay-per-view. And when they showed up, I remember like half of the locker room being like, God, like, we don't want to have to fight today, because today is supposed to be like a day about this. And like I remember Booker T just like, nah, man, big fan, just wanted to be part of this. And like Kevin's just like, and Paul went into like a side room with Kevin and like basically told Kevin, like, probably backtrack, but like, I can't have you here, you know? But wow, so man, I forgot about half this stuff. I'm glad Paul, you're here.
Paul was good for that stuff when we did WrestlePalooza in Atlanta. There's a certain hotel. I don't even want you to stay at it. WCW has a mole at the lobby at the front desk. If you stay there, they will plant drugs in your room. If you get arrested, you're fired and all that stuff. And then the girlfriend at the time booked a room there. I was like, what are you doing? You're going to get me fired. Get a new hotel. Cause I was so brainwashed and stuff.
Dude, that pay-per-view, I know we're supposed to be talking about Barely. I remember Terry Taylor showing up and driving up in his gold Benz, and Paul wanted us to like beat the crap out of him. And he did his, you know, pull up his pants, do his walk to him. And like, he was putting his hands out, like he was all mad. And Terry Taylor just got back in his car and drove away. And then years later, talking to Terry Taylor, he was like, Paul's the one who invited me to come to the show.
Hey, you always knew Paul was going to get mad when he turned his hat around, like over the top. So Sylvester Stallone and over the top, like right before he, you know, did the arm wrestling thing. That's when you knew Paul was about to get serious.
A lot of people would talk smack about Paul, and, you know, at times deservingly so.
I love him, you know.
When the last pay-per-view, or one of the last pay-per-views in LA. He was the first out the curtain, literally fighting in the streets with the wrestlers. And, you know, so we always give him, I always give him props for that too. And, you know, he deserves all the props in the world because he was the leader. And yes, we had a lot of freedom and we had a lot of, you know, I want to say co-leaders and people were doing a lot to within the company. But yes, he was in WWE's pocket, but you know what? He did everything he could to keep ECW running as well as his parents' money. So, and for this night and for Barely Legal, they'll be talking about it for years and years to come just because it was a first, just like AEW had their first and we didn't think that would happen and there'd be competition and all that stuff. AEW has, ECW has always set the bar for, it was almost like the Simpsons where, I'm not the Simpsons, South Park, no, yeah, South Park said the Simpsons. Simpsons did it first, kind of like ECW. We did a lot of firsts too.
And, you know, for you, like for both of you, I mean, you still frequent that building. You know, everyone still refers to that building as the ECW Arena in South Philly. And it is. And it looks a lot different than it did, you know, 23 years ago. I mean, you know, it looks a hell of a lot nicer than it did 23 years ago. But, you know, for you, though, you know, when you walk in that building, even now, do you get chills? Does it bring back memories of that first ever pay-per-view for you?
I live literally, I'm a 10-minute walk from that building. So I pass it almost every day. And every time I pass it, a new memory pops up, whether it's, you know, ECW or now with Tommy's House of Hardcore running there and stuff like that. And it's beautiful now. They, the way it looks now, I describe it as they literally put lipstick on a pig. Because the and hats off to Roger who runs the building. He's doing amazing things with it now. But, the cool thing about that building is when, you know, I'm there for Tommy's House of Hardcore or a convention and stuff like that, others wrestlers who haven't never worked there or it's their first time there, they'll come up to me and ask me, oh, where was the camera set up?
Yeah.
Where was the entranceway? Where's the eagle's nest and stuff like that? So I get a kick out of, you know, giving everybody, like I call it the 25-cent tour of the ECW arena, you know?
I do like the same thing. I'll be choke slammed over there. New Jack used to be jumped off over there. And, you know, you talk about, I was a great analogy what Meanie just said for the fact that the Eagles got their Super Bowl rings there. When I first heard about that, I was like, what? Like they're getting their rings there. And then when you see how the place has evolved, but the ghosts and the memories and, you know, all of our DNA is splattered all over that building. It's the most special arena in the world. When everything gets better, I hope to run another show. But if you're a wrestling fan, it has to be, you know, Madison Square Garden, the ECW Arena. To me, Rosemont Horizon are the top three wrestling venues that are still around today.
I mean, the ECW Arena was basically our sportatorium. When you think about all the shows from like World Class and people talk about how run down it was and there, you can look up in the ceiling and see rats running down the pipes and stuff like that. But there's so many memories that you can't replace in a building like that. And like you said, we spilt blood there, we broke bones there. And the fact that, you know, people, even if there's not a show, if they're in town for like a WWE show, they'll drive by the building and take a photo outside like it's a tourist attraction, because you have Tony Luke's right around the corner and you get a cheesesteak. They park the car outside, they'll have their cheesesteak out Tony Luke's, just thinking about ECW and, you know, what that building meant to everybody.
And you know,
oh, I'm sorry, Tommy, not to cut you off, but like, unlike the Sportatorium, which is, you know, was demolished, you know, I guess close to 15 years now, you know, that building still stands. So for a lot of people, that is a historical landmark, especially when it comes to pro wrestling.
Yeah. And I, you know, Meanie said it best, like people tag me when, hey, look where I'm at, you know, went to Tony Luke's, and it was just such an amazing time. And another thing that Meanie didn't say, but I just totally thought about, like, besides memories, it's friendships and things that have been forged forever. And, you know, Terry Funk was screaming forever, forever. But
goddamn, Meanie,
I can go back and like think of like so many different times in my life, or especially going back and looking at that. And I was just like, you know, damn, like I've had friendships with people for so many years. And even if you don't see them, like the moment me and Brian come back and talk, like Brian's been my friend since his first ever match where I just knew him. But like we've always been straight up, or like when we saw the stuff on Vice where it was me, Sandman, New Jack, Mustafa, and we were just like, hey, what's going on? There are memories that and friendships that have been forged a lifetime over men and women destroying their bodies for something we believed in. And that's why for me, I have no regrets. And, you know, April, what was it, 13th, you said the date was?
April 13th, 1997.
Was just another great day in the history of, you know, my life. So thank you, everyone, for who's been a part of it.
Well, thank you to Beulah. Thank you, Blue Meanie. Again, Mind of the Meanie, the podcast, you know, follow at Mind of the Meanie. And again, April 13th, 1997 is that date and barely legal. And thank you, everyone, for joining us on that very historic night, the first ever ECW pay-per-view, Barely Legal.
This has been Busted Open's Miracle on the Mat special. Check SiriusXM On Demand for more SiriusXM Fight Nation content and follow us on Twitter at Busted Open Radio.